down the
emergency for the first time.
This is Jim, and
receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 388.JL0112, certificate number 27612, Dutch elm disease.
I speak for the trees. Let them grow. Let them grow.
What's your relationship to the forest, Ken? I know. I think of you as kind of a forest creature.
I am the young prince of the forest, like Bambi.
Mm-hmm.
As a young boy, I liked to gambol and frolic there.
Did you?
Eventually, my antlers grew, and I took it over and made it my own.
Were your parents killed in a devastating forest fire?
They were, but that's actually unrelated.
Oh, I see. A completely different forest, different time.
I love the forest. I was walking in. You know, the trees are starting to bud here. We're recording this in the spring.
Yeah.
The trees are starting to bud here in our beautiful Northwest forest. And I was walking through some woods not far from my house. And I was watching the Douglas firs do this thing they do in the Northwest where they'll kind of shimmy in wind.
Yeah.
And it'll look like they're dancing, kind of, they're doing like a slow motion hula. And I was thinking about how, as much as I love the less deciduous forests of the Northeast, their trees do not dance the way our tall evergreens do. I feel very at peace in the forest. And it's one of the things I really remember about coming home to Seattle in the summers when we lived overseas and cut in a large treeless Asian city. It's just watching those big Western hemlocks and Douglas firs and cedars kind of swaying like that in an evening breeze. It's unforgettable.
Yeah. I also, as you know, I'm a forest dweller, a wood elf.
That's right.
My new house is on a piece of property that has a lot of mature trees and, you know, like quite a few evergreens, big cedars and firs, but also a lot of big leaf maples and mature deciduous trees. For futurelings that probably are trees, we don't need to explain the difference between deciduous trees, which lose their leaves in the fall, and evergreen trees, which have various needles and other kinds of...
Those are the two races of our listeners.
The two races.
They're
deciduous and
deciduous
evergreen.
The deciduous are super racist about the coniferous.
And they live in different cities. And, yeah. But what we don't have experience of, you and I, growing up in the Northwest, are the hardwood forests of the East Coast. And and we can be forgiven for not having that experience, both because we don't live on the East Coast, but also because the hardwood forests in the Northeast and in the Southeast are now just a shadow of their former selves. No one of our generation can appreciate what the Eastern forests and in Europe also. What the hardwood forests of the recent past were like.
They built this country without those hardwoods and, you know, in some cases, the food stuff they provided. I mean, that's what led those areas to be settled. But unfortunately, it was that settlement that then pretty much deforested huge swaths of it. So thanks for those hardwoods, guys.
Well, you know, the hardwood forests were not decimated by logging or fires or misuse. We didn't hump the trees into non-existence.
Did you say hump or hunt?
Hump. We didn't bring.
I guess we didn't do either. To my knowledge,
pigs that dug them up. No, in fact, the hardwood forests of the United States were destroyed by that patient enemy, the fungus.
And as recently as the 20th century.
In most cases, until even my father's and mother's lifetimes, even your father's and mother's lifetimes, the hardwood forests of the eastern states, I guess, every state to the east of the Appalachian Mountains, and also this is true in Canada and in Europe, those forests were intact and were devastated by fungal infections that were brought from faraway places as part of what became a kind of, the early international trade in wood and wood products. So
they were safe as long as we weren't getting things from other continents that might have beetles and fungi in them.
That's right.
But as soon as we started getting things that might have beetles and fungi in them, boy, those beetles and fungi had a heyday.
Beetles and fungi. The first tree to suffer was the American chestnut, which once upon a time, not that long ago, comprised over 70% of the trees in American hardwood forests.
You could swing from Maine to Michigan on the branches of American chestnut trees and never once touch the ground.
That's right. And they produced chestnuts, which were a valuable foodstuff for animals and humans.
They produce chestnuts every year, not like oaks that only drop acorns sometimes. Like, they're a reliable food you can sock away.
And wonderful wood for building, wonderful wood for fuel, wonderful wood for everything that you could use wood for. And at one point, there were estimated over 4 billion chestnut trees in North America.
Well, surely that's enough that they could withstand anything.
Well, sadly, no.
What?
I'm afraid to report to you, Ken, that the chestnut blight, which is a fungus and an imported one, got upon our chestnut trees and lay waste to them, devastating our forests, devastating our people.
One tear just rolled down John's cheek as I threw a piece of litter at him.
Now, I'm afraid that these forests are, I have no conception of them. And I know of them only from my mother's reports of how different the world looks to her now than it did when she was a child.
Or just reading Thoreau, you know, like these majestic chestnut trees are pretty much lost to us now, except in, you know, Longfellow poems about them.
Right. And
what does your mom say?
Well, my mom's experience, and I think this is true for most of the urban populations of North America and Europe. Her experience was less that the chestnut trees were devastated by a blight, because the chestnuts comprised the trees of a forest. If you were to find a stand of forest, or if you were to fly over a mountain range, you were looking down at chestnuts. And so, for instance, what people go to now to see the leaves change in the Northeast,
the leaf peepers,
you know, that would have been true across the whole East Coast. You wouldn't need to go to Vermont to watch the leaves change. But what made a greater impact in her life, and I think in a lot of people's lives, was the American elm tree that was devastated in a couple of different times in the 20th century by Dutch elm disease, because the elm tree was used as an urban tree. The elm tree was a tall and fast growing and vase shaped deciduous tree that was used to line the big boulevard in town, and the elm tree.
Chestnuts would be too tall, I guess, but elm trees are the right shape for
the right shape, planting. And just sort of a decorative tree that dances in the wind. Now, perhaps it doesn't hula.
It doesn't hula.
But they were used much more prominently, and I think they were probably hardier in an urban environment. Mm-hmm. So that elm trees were, and also, you know, a native tree that populated the forest, but they were the most prominent, large, you know, big leaf shade tree of American cities and of the, you know, the American East, and also true throughout Europe. There were, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were 30,000 elms in Paris. Elms were the main tree in Amsterdam. They were
5,200 American cities have an elm street.
Right. And there's a reason why. It was the street that was lined with elms. That's why they called it that.
And Freddy Krueger's.
Right. It's not just his nightmare. It's our collective nightmare.
It's a nightmare on my street.
On all streets.
To coin a phrase.
Elm trees were prominent throughout the United Kingdom. Like elms were the primary tree that made cities shady and
ask a city beautiful. Kid to draw a tree. Like that's their platonic ideal of a tree,
right.
Is an elm.
And there's a lot of suggestion that elm disease and these funguses that are fungi, as our listeners prefer.
Is that right? Have they all risen up with one voice?
I can't decide which of our futurelings we're mocking at any given time. But they're vulnerable to a form of fungus that's a wide category of fungus called the sac fungus.
Oh, so it's not just one species.
Like, well, there are a lot of sac fungi. So, for instance, like morels and truffles, but also yeasts. I mean, they're all sac fungi,
and they're all bad for elms, or at least a lot of them are.
No, oh, okay. But the fungi that infect elm trees, there are several varieties of it, and they're all part of the Ophiostoma group of sac fungi. The first one to arrive in North America was called Ophiostoma ulmi.
Ulmi meaning elms. Edward James Ulmus is Spanish for Edward James Elms.
That's right. Ulm, Germany is just Elm, Germany.
Oh, that's true, huh?
Yeah.
I didn't think about that.
Named after what presumably were all the beautiful elms in Ulm.
Ulmer Fudd just means Elmer Fudd.
Every time you pause to think of a word and you say Ulm, it's just a Norman
that's
elm.
That's my mantra.
Ulm.
Ulm.
It arrived in America in the early part of the 20th century, and initially it came in a shipment of wood from Europe that was meant to be used as veneer in furniture.
Did it come from the Netherlands? Is that why?
Originally, it was identified in the Netherlands because it was infecting elms in the Netherlands, too.
Oh.
And the way...
So Dutch elm disease is maybe not Dutch.
Not Dutch. It's always a question. Did it come from Asia? How is it being sort of... what is its origin point and how is it promulgated?
I had no idea until it became a political football recently that the Spanish flu of 1918...
Not Spanish.
Did not originate in Spanish. They were just the ones that weren't covering up the deaths.
Right.
So...
when it was in the newspaper, it was like, wow, this big flu in Spain. Meanwhile, ravaging the entire world.
There's some theory that it like originated in the American Midwest and then got to Spain.
And that it originated in a military base.
We dodged a bullet there by covering up those deaths. That would have been American flu. What a black eye.
American flu. That's not what you want. Who would immigrate here and buy our blenders?
American flu should be the name for just some diarrhea you get from Taco Bell. I've got the American flu.
Gross. Oh. I think that is what we say. the way the fungus works, the way it kills an elm tree is in a way kind of similar to the coronavirus in that it triggers an immune response from the tree that ends up overreacting and killing the tree. So
it's like lupus or something.
What a tree does when it's being attacked is it, you know... By orcs. When a tree is attacked by orcs...
It marches on Isengard.
What it does...
I don't actually
throom,
know.
Throom, throom,
what does
throom.
A tree do, actually, when it's being attacked? Because they can't... I mean, they don't have metabolisms.
What
right?
happens is a tree secretes sap, and it and the sap plugs up the damage that whatever the disease or insect is inflicting.
So
upon
sap
the tree.
Has an immune property as well, and whatever circulatory stuff
and
it
sap
does.
Is
that's why it's glue like. That's why it's sticky.
That's right. It's also antibacterial. Like sap is kind of amazing stuff, but when a tree overreacts, right? What it is doing is it's actually sealing up the channels that a tree uses underneath its, you know, in its cadmium.
It's cambium and
cambium,
xylem and phloem.
Right, and the flow from root to leaf and back again. The sap will go in and block that passage.
This is just like when you're sick and your immune system makes more mucus, but then you get a stuffy nose.
It's exactly what it is. A tree can actually strangle itself.
It just dies of a stuffy nose.
By plugging up, by clogging all of its vascular system.
Wow.
Now, in the case of Dutch elm disease, it's made worse by the fact that it is transmitted via bark beetles. And bark beetles are a whole kind of type of beetle, and there are many, many varieties. And they live underneath the bark in a tree, and they provide a necessary service, as so many critters do when the world is working perfectly.
But somehow they get fungus?
What happens is the beetles, normally, a bark beetle will live in a dying tree, and the bark beetle, you know, breeding beneath the surface of the bark is part of the, you know, the transformation of a dead snag into eventually a fallen snag and then sawdust, right? I mean, beetles are playing a role in the ecosystem, in the cycle of life of a tree.
Somebody's got to eat trees. I don't want to do it.
Beetles will also, bark beetles will get under the skin of you know, teacher trees and other adult trees that can get irritated by them. And they can live inside of, under the bark of healthy trees and, you know, and can do damage to trees. But in the case of the Dutch elm disease, the bark beetle, when the fungus creates an immune reaction in the tree and the tree secretes sap, the sap can get on a bark beetle and transmit the fungus. So as the beetle,
it just goes to a different tree
or and within the tree.
This is a perfect analogy for stuffy nose. Again, I sneeze on somebody and just a little droplet of my sap is what spreads the fungus takes. Or in this case, coronavirus.
So the beetles then end up as they, and it's really the beetles that bring the Dutch elm disease initially, in that initial shipment of wood, it was beetles that were under the bark that escaped once they got here.
Meet the beetles.
Here they are. Ah. She loves you. But in this case, she loves the delicious sap of the American elm.
Do they eat the sap? No, they're just getting it stuck on them because sap has to be sticky.
Yeah, and then the beetles are tunneling under the bark, and they're just spreading the fungus everywhere they go.
I know when the first chestnut started to die, you know, people just thought, well, there's billions of these, we're going to be fine. And when the blight started to spread, they thought, well, we'll just they tried social distancing, basically. Right. They tried to create fire breaks, and it turns out it doesn't matter because beetles or whatever pollen, whatever is carrying the vector around, does not, it, you know, it doesn't pass twig to twig.
Well, in the United States, there was a recognition of how devastating this Dutch elm disease was. It first sort of was identified and arrived on our shores in the 1920s. But it was, people understood how it was transmitted and how devastating it was. And there was a concentrated effort to contain it by sort of sanitary felling of diseased trees, the way that, you know, if it would manifest in a large branch of an elm, you could cut that branch off and and burn the wood and contain it.
Just like a nursing home. I mean, you don't burn it, but you stop people from visiting it.
You stop, yeah, right. You do containment. You do social distancing of trees.
I mean,
trees.
You could burn it, but I don't recommend it.
And in New York City, they managed to contain Dutch elm disease all through the 1930s by this rigorous practice of containment and social distancing.
Contact tracing.
That's right.
Of beetles.
And they were successful in containing Dutch elm disease until World War II, at which point the demand for resources and people's attention shifted.
They just don't have the workforce anymore to...
Yeah, they just were doing other things and they
figured, had to choose Nazis or bark beetles.
And also, I think they'd been so successful, it's easy to think like, well, we'll just leave this alone for a little bit while we fight the enemy and we'll be back soon.
There's definitely an analogy for that in our day, except instead of fighting the enemy, it's just people wanting to go to Macaroni Grill.
That's right. Well, I need my haircut, Ken, and my roots are showing.
I need my haircut so bad. Yeah, speaking of trees, your roots are showing.
But As soon as New York stopped being vigilant about the spread of Dutch elm, it took off across America.
Oh, so it was not, it had been contained in New York. There weren't really big other outbreaks.
No, there were. I mean, places like Hartford, Connecticut. I mean, it was on the East Coast, and it had devastated the elm populations of several cities. But there was also real hard work being done to contain it, mm-hmm. contain it to the East Coast.
But when it spread to other cities, it was coming from that initial Northeast.
Yeah.
Wow.
And by 1950, Dutch elm disease had arrived in Detroit. And by 1960, it was in Chicago. And you could watch it march across the United States. And this was the era that my mom lived in. She was born in 1934 and lived in Ohio. And in 1950, when Dutch elm disease arrived in Detroit, she was in Western Ohio, right? So she was a teenager, and she still lived in a city with an elm street that had beautiful elms. And by the time she was in college, she watched the elms in her town die, and then watched the elms in the neighboring town die. You could watch it go from town to town.
Yeah, and people have an emotional connection to the trees on their street and in their backyards. And it's not exactly like losing somebody you know, but you do grieve, especially when it's so inexorable and you know it's going to be the one next door next.
And scientists and biologists and botanists were all working overtime trying to come up with a solution, right? There were so many efforts being made to eradicate the beetles, to inoculate the trees.
Eradicate the Beetles is a pretty good album name.
Yeah, Eradicate the Beetles. Are you kidding me? Why is there not an album called that? Let me write that down.
Happiness is a warm gun.
Because of the nature of the infection, it is possible to inoculate trees. It just didn't turn out to work very well.
By inoculate, do you do the same thing?
You inject the tree with a weakened
emasculated
form.
Version?
Yeah, a weakened form of the fungus, and try to get the tree to build up an immune response. In the 50s and 60s, the brand new, super exciting insecticide, DDT, was the preferred method that that municipalities were using to combat the beetle.
To kill the beetles.
And it was really DDT as used to combat Dutch elm disease that inspired Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. So it was trying to fight Dutch elm disease that sparked the American environmental movement.
I have some vague idea that DDT was actually, I mean, was it working? Was it holding the line against Dutch elm disease? Because I know that DDT has actually started to be used again, I think, in certain limited areas, because even Rachel Carson admits it's probably a really good insecticide.
It was a really good insecticide, and a lot of the pushback that's coming now about her book and the anti-DDT thing was the suggestion that a lot of that a lot of the bird deaths and...
Oh, it thinned eggshells, right?
Thinning of eggshells was actually a result of mercury poisoning and lead poisoning that was in the soil from other industrial process.
It's our guy from the leaded gas episode again. Now he's killing baby birds.
Leaded gas is the one bad thing.
It all comes back
everything to leaded gas. Everything else is fine.
Well, it probably means that everything else is bad. The loss of leaded gas has been the only thing that's gone right in America over the last 50 years. And that's why crime stats are down and the baby birds are happier.
This is also, they've done a wonderful job, and they did, starting back then, in controlling Dutch elm disease in isolated locations, in locations that they could... Because it's very resource intensive to monitor a stand of elm trees. They've succeeded in doing it in the mall in Washington, D.C.
Oh, those are all still elms?
American elms. But it's because the mall has a dedicated staff of people whose only job is to keep those elm trees alive. And so they've managed to keep, you know, beautiful elms in Washington, D.C. But it's too resource intensive for most places. Other places in... North America that have retained their stands of elms are places like Winnipeg, which, if you've ever been to Winnipeg...
I have not.
Winnipeg is like kind of a marvelous little Midwestern city in Canada, but it is surrounded on all sides by 100 million miles of nothing. So here's Winnipeg, and it's like a tropical island, except in totally frozen...
Except for the weather.
...freezing Canada. But
then in what ways is it like a tropical
it's
island?
It's really not at all, except that Winnipeg itself, when you're there, it feels like Milwaukee. You know, it has... It's
got, an oasis.
It's wonderful architecture. It's wonderful tree-lined streets. It's a cultural oasis for its region.
Have you seen the Guy Madden movie about his childhood in Winnipeg?
Mm-mm.
I recommend My Winnipeg. It's kind of a phantasmagorical mix of fact and fiction about mid-century Winnipeg.
It's a super neat place, but it's surrounded on all sides by the steppes of Canada, right? It's just like endless, treeless nothingness. So Winnipeg still has 200,000 elm trees.
Because the Beatles can't get there.
Boy, what the Beatles can't, you know, they couldn't walk there, right? And they've done a good enough job of keeping like veneer out of there.
Well, we can't let the Beatles know. I hope they're not listening to this.
Shh, don't let the Beatles know.
ASMR.
There are places in Europe that still have like Amsterdam and The Hague have wonderful stands of elm trees, and so much so that they advertise themselves as the elm cities.
It's probably the same as the National Mall, right? They just throw manpower at,
yeah, yeah, right. I mean, you can... Amsterdam is such a cultivated environment. Like, you know, they run a fine-tooth comb through that city and have for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Although they can't keep hippies out.
I don't think they're really trying
they
that hard.
They can't even really keep the bikes out of the canals.
It's like Dutch elm disease. they tried to keep all the hippies in one particular district, and it's working out okay.
Unfortunately for the United States, Dutch elm disease was kind of ravaging the country, but it was not even really the most virulent form. The Ophiostoma ulmi was a kind of mild form of elm disease.
Uh-oh.
And in the 1960s, a extremely virulent form of it called Ophiostoma novo ulmi arrived from Japan, and
this is like the Godzilla mutated.
Yeah, it swept across the United States like a raging firestorm.
Also killing elms?
Killing elms right and left, such that people that can remember the 1970s can remember a time when you just watched the trees of a city just evaporate. And
that's sad. Urban tree cover is important.
When we look at pictures of Seattle from 100 years ago, we kind of often have the opposite experience, because when they built Seattle, what they did was come to a place where there were like stands of old growth fir that were probably 30 feet around, and they were all lumbered.
Yay, let's cut these down.
And then they built this Victorian city. And when you look at old, you know, like sepia tinted photographs of Seattle, there are no trees.
It's treeless, yeah.
It's just house after house after house after house. And you compare those to modern photographs, and now we have these beautiful trees. But if you look at photographs of Midwestern cities, Eastern cities from 100 years ago, and then compare them to today, it's the opposite effect.
All the big, beautiful trees are gone.
Yeah.
In Seattle, the only trees that die are the ones that are like intentionally poisoned by rich people who want nicer views.
Right. Or chopped down by somebody that just moved in and bought the old house and was like, oh, I don't want any of these trees around here.
I saw recently that Seattle Parks Department had discovered somebody had actually drilled a hole in a tree and injected poison multiple times just to kill the tree and improve their view. It's clear there's a neighborhood, any one of whose houses could have done it. So the city, of the two trees that have been targeted, the city had to cut one down. They think they can save the other one, but for the one they cut down, they planted four new ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Take 50 that. Years from now, you'll see.
Your kids will be so mad.
The desire to have elm trees and chestnut trees, to have these great old hardwood trees, as you know, it encouraged people, botanists, to try and find new elm varieties to plant that are resistant to Dutch elm disease. And there are varieties that are. There are Asian elm trees that naturally were resistant to some of these pests that, you know, that ended up being imported pests. But it turned out that there were a few American varieties of elms that were less vulnerable to the disease. And there were great projects to try and breed different varieties of elms, the more resistant varieties with the more beautiful,
with the qualities you want
varieties. Yeah. But to whatever degree, fungus resistance was not as easily bred into a tree.
It turns out it's the same gene. The thing that makes you pretty is the same that makes you fungus resistant. Just like in life, all these beautiful people with their porcelain skin, you know, that they'll just get knocked over by a breeze.
It's definitely true for me. I'm beautiful and very much not fungus resistant. Those have not been successful projects, but there are some varieties like the Princeton variety of American elm, the Valley Forge variety that are now places are being encouraged to plant these resistant elms because elms they continue to be vulnerable to this fungus. It's not like any kind of herd immunity resulted from the disease. And elm trees are...
It would be grove immunity, by the way.
Grove immunity, right. Elms die and will send up shoots. You know, they'll send up... They'll try to survive. And those new shoots will last for as long as it takes for the...
Just to get fungus out of their
minds.
Yeah,
the beetles and the fungus to get after them. The one... in the United Kingdom, there are elms which have been... basically coppiced into hedgerows. So the elms haven't...
Is there a bustle in them?
There is. It's the bustle of them continuing to survive Dutch elm disease. Because they're constantly being shaped into hedges. And so whatever part of them gets diseased, you know, kind of gets chopped off
every spring.
And things that kill one plant, you know, it will send up shoots, but those shoots get intermixed as part of a hedge. And so the hedgerows have survived.
But I don't want a hedgerow. Well, I want a big, beautiful elm tree, John.
There are plenty of places where elm disease was kept out. Brighton in England still has a lot of its elms. The Isle of Man is sequestered.
Literally an island, unless a beetle comes in on a shipment of something.
That's right.
Most of the elms are not extinct, but most of them are gone.
It's a question of in terms of replanting them, you can only really count on the ones that are immune to this fungus to survive. And that's not very many varieties. In the case of the chestnut, you know, these trees in trying to take over or be replanted as forest trees, you know, they have to compete with other trees because the way a forest grows, there's the first layer of trees and that shades the understory, which allows that second generation of second type of trees to come up. And then they provide an environment that makes that third generation of trees possible. Mm-hmm. And so to try and reintroduce a chestnut into that forest ecology and hope that it takes over, or the elm tree, I mean, elm trees being urban trees, you can treat them more individually.
You don't worry about the ecosystem so much. I know with the chestnuts, they tried to bring in other species that were, you know, Asian species of chestnuts that were already resistant to whatever their blight was. And yeah, you couldn't introduce them to a forest because they didn't grow up the same way. They would just kind of grow out and then they'd be under the canopy of an existing forest and they wouldn't make it.
They couldn't compete and survive. Right. And that is kind of the challenge. I mean, a chestnut is a fast growing tree and is a strong tree, but to put it in the forest, I think that they believe that chestnuts can be reintroduced, but they just have to be hardy to this blight. There's a third American hardwood tree, the butternut tree, which is a kind of walnut tree, which also was a tree that filled forests and provided food, and has sort of recently succumbed to beetles and blight, and it's the kind of the third domino.
That's ominous.
In a game of three dominoes.
Well, I mean, yeah, it just means that any tree is vulnerable to this. All your hardwoods are going to be gone.
Well, all your hardwoods belong to us.
Say the beetles.
The idea of this being a recent phenomenon as a result of
globalization,
the global trade of hardwoods, has recently gotten a little bit of pushback because scientists have found evidence that there have been elm blights before, kind of like elm trees were the majority tree in Europe in prehistoric times. You know, Europe was covered from one end to the other with giant forests.
Dinosaur streets lined with elms.
And there's fossil record of in 4000 BC, all the elm trees of Europe all dying at once.
I wonder how you can see the blight. I guess they just disappear from the record. You don't see blighted trees. You just see the elms go away.
They disappear from the record. And I think traditionally people thought, or the habit has been for a while to think of that as the result of not a meteor strike in 4000 BC, but the logging of the forests by prehistoric man, right? Like here comes...
suddenly they invented the saw.
That's right. Here come the, you know, they got the stirrup and they've got their leather shoes stuffed with straw and now they're chopping down all the forest for wood. But that never really made that much sense because there were an awful lot of forest and not that many utsis, to decimate the entire elm cover of Europe.
Right. If each individual utsis can chop down a tree a week, it's just not going to happen.
That's an awful lot of utzes, more than there are or were. It happened again in 1000 BC, and I think there are some fossilized beetles that are bark beetles that they've kind of found in conjunction with the evidence of these forest destroying epochs, moments in time. And as recently as the early 19th century, was staring us right in the face, plenty of written record of smaller outbreaks of elm killing diseases in European cities because the diseases in those episodes weren't that virulent, no one made the connection when it happened 100 years later.
I know with the New York Times did a story not too long ago about how one hope for the American chestnut might be genetic engineering. Like they haven't had good luck breeding resistant trees together, but they've like found the gene that will make the tree produce some protein that'll break down the acid. And now they've got to prove that this is not, I mean, they've got to prove to government, three government oversight agencies, that this is not dangerous. You know, you got to try feeding it to birds and see what happens when the birds' nests are made out of these. And you got to see what happens when it leaches into the water. And you know, there's a lot of testing you have to do, but then you got to persuade all these no genetically modified, plant granola protester types.
Right.
That it's better to have new tinkered with chestnuts than no chestnuts at all. And that's a harder sell.
Well, and we are creating now, what we're doing is replacing a native species with a replica of it. And in a way, this is something that was inevitable, I guess, for the United States, because there is no forest in Europe that isn't the product of human intervention, right? There's no old growth forest in Western Europe. Everything has been manipulated and farmed and crafted. And if you want it to look natural, you can make it look natural. If you want to farm trees, you can farm trees. And in the United States, we were lucky enough to have such a lot of space and so many natural resources that for the last 200 years, we could continue to explore, could continue to discover new forests that were more or less, at least if not pristine, then had only been logged once and then left alone. And so we come to think of the forest as a naturally occurring and wild place rather than one that is cared for or built, manipulated.
Shaped by man.
But that's no longer the case here. There's not really any, I mean, there are places on the Olympic Peninsula. There are areas that we have set aside as national parks that are hopefully oases. Islands.
If not old growth, at least middle-aged.
Middle-aged
starting growth. To play with model railroads growth.
But forests. The rest of the forests, the hardwood forests of the East, we have to begin to think of them as gardens. And we have to begin to imagine cultivating a facsimile of the hardwood forests of 100 or 200 years ago. In the same way that if we're going to take the fences down in the Great Plains and reintroduce buffalo, and maybe re-genetically engineer the passenger pigeon, that those things are not, they're not any more authentic than if we introduced rhinoceros to the Great Plains.
Well, they're a little more authentic. I mean, these aren't hologram trees we're talking about. It's the same species.
Right.
We've just tweaked one of the genes to make it hardier. And yeah, there will be some effects, and what you want to make sure is that they're good and not bad effects for the garden you want, as you're saying.
It's almost exactly analogous to the fact that I just contracted with a company in Milwaukee to manufacture for me some pink ceramic bathroom tile that no one makes anymore, but that was one of their main products in 1955, and I'm restoring my 1955 bathroom.
You've got your avocado toilet all ready to go.
And when you come into my house at some long future date, and you look at my pink bathroom, you're going to think, "Wow, a perfectly preserved 1955 bathroom." What you don't realize is that I had to personally contact the great grandson of the guy that made that tile and say, "Fire up the old tile plant, Sonny."
I will cop to reprinting 80s and 90s concert tees through online t-shirt presses, just with a facsimile of the old design, you know, finding old graphics and recreating the right color palette.
You know, the real trick of that, and this was popular 20 years ago, I had a girlfriend that was in the vintage clothing market, and she said what the unscrupulous would do is go to thrift stores and find plain t-shirts from the 70s.
Oh, it's like painting art forgeries on the correct parchment, on the correct, or the correct canvas or whatever.
And then you could put a screen print on that looked all weathered and screwed up. And if you were a vintage t-shirt shopper, you would check the label, you'd check the fabric, and you'd go, yeah, this is an authentic Hanes t-shirt from 1975.
I'd go further than that. I would say that is authentic now. I mean, I know it's not. You can go back in time and prove that it didn't exist at that New Order show or whatever.
Right. It's not actually a Rolling Stones concert
team. It's not a Husker Du shirt, but it is. It's good enough, right?
Well, that's the question.
Well, this is something we have not thought of as far as battling the coronavirus. You know, what if you just got rid of people and replaced them with
people that were invulnerable to viruses?
A slightly more virus-resistant replica that otherwise acts just like people do.
We are 100% making this show for precisely those people.
Good job, replica humans. You came through. And that concludes Dutch Elm Disease. Entry 388.JL0112, certificate number 27612, in the omnibus. Futurelings, should your replica eyeballs still crave social media, you should know that John and I were active in the internet of our era. You could follow the show at Omnibus Project. Individually, we were at Ken Jennings and not John Roderick. You can probably guess which of us used which handles.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Slow down. Why don't we tweet from each other's account for a week?
April Fool's Day.
Every one of my tweets will be, hey, it's me, Ken Jennings. Follow my friend John Roderick. Hey, it's my new tweet about John Roderick.
I'm at John Roderick. I smell and my butt smells. Bye. That's all I would ever do with that power.
Poopy, poopy, poopy.
I mean, we would definitely have to give each other the keys back because we'd be in this Mexican standoff.
Right.
We'd own each other's accounts.
Right. I would own your account for sure.
Except I'd have a lot more followers to lose than you would.
You wouldn't be losing them. You'd just be sharing them with me.
That's true.
From he who can afford to him who cannot.
From each according to his... social media ability to each according not to ability, his social ability.
Not ability.
Need. Oh, I see. Yeah, not, it's not a meritocracy.
No.
These are followers I inherited from my parents.
Yeah, my tweets are darn good tweets.
I wonder if this is going to be. We don't have this issue yet because we're still in the first generation of social media stunted people.
Oh, when your kid inherits your tweets?
Yeah, at some point, could you inherit your dad's follower count? Will it just be like today's trust fund kids who? Who, you know, they get a million likes for everything they do because they got their parents' followers?
Well, so this is interesting. I have a good friend who works for a local billionaire.
A late local billionaire?
A late local billionaire. And said late local billionaire had an enormous collection of digital media. And upon his death, there was suddenly within his estate a question of what to do with what surely constituted hundreds of millions of dollars worth of digital media. And they realized that digital rights, there was no,
there's no
provision
state law
for inheriting the digital rights or bequeathing those digital rights. If you bought a song on iTunes and you die, does your kid own the song?
That's certainly by design.
And so all of a sudden, but you know, in most cases when you die and nobody can access your iTunes account, like who cares, boo hoo. But in the case of this late departed
Seahawks owning
Seattle billionaire, he had, I mean, millions and millions and millions of books and films and TV and...
He must have just bought stuff compulsively. He doesn't have any more free time than you and I do to watch movies, probably less.
He developed an entire system, which was kind of iPad-based but proprietary hardware, mm-hmm. where he had these kind of these tablets that you could call up anything. You could call up...
He wanted to be the library computer of his beloved Starship Enterprise.
That's right. It was just like, I'd like the sheet music to Star Spangled Banner. Boom, there it is. I would like to watch the, you know, like the Godfather dubbed into Norwegian. Boom, there it is.
Are media rights transferable today? Could you get around this by bequeathing them on your deathbed? Could you give them as gifts to the living?
So this is the problem, and my close associate who works for the estate of said late departed billionaire,
who rhymes with small gallon,
has admonished me, like, by the shirt, grabbed me by the front of my shirt and said,
buy physical media.
Yeah. Never get rid of a book or a CD or a DVD or anything, because they're the only media that are real. And I'm like, DVDs aren't real. When was the last time you saw a DVD player except at Ken Jennings's house? and yet, you know, realer than keeping it in the cloud and then finding that you're not able to give that to your kids. And of course, cloud media services are never going to allow you to bequeath your Star Wars subscriptions to your kid.
It would just end sales.
Yeah,
if you could get your parents' files.
So it's, I think, a little researched or little thought of consequence of the digitization of everything.
It's because we're all convinced we're the last generation.
Yeah, right.
If you think you're never going to have kids, like, you're not worried about your dog getting your Godfather
and
movies.
It is part of the premise of this show, right? That we're worried that although the Marches of John Philip Sousa are going to make it into the cloud, are the Marches of Bill Sousa, his younger brother?
His less talented and possibly less existent younger brother?
Probably not. And that's why the Omnibus Project is here.
I should hook up your friend with, like, Scarecrow Video. She's like a cautionary tale of...
She's a member of Scarecrow
Video. She's well aware.
Yeah, she's fine. I mean, she's fine.
Well, no, I don't mean she should be writing more videos. I'm just saying they should be leveraging her testimony in their in their marketing.
Well, no, you know, the reason I'm so cautious, I'm not very cautious. I've basically outed her in every respect.
Her phone number is 206.
But, you know, she still is employed there as part of that team. So yeah. She's not going to be able to, she still won't tell me 3/4 of the things because of some NDA she signed back in the 80s.
The NDA said you can only tell your friends a quarter of things about your job. Choose which ones.
Only tell people you know the tantalizing bit and then nothing more.
In addition to social media, please email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Tell us 1/4 of your secrets. Send us 1/4 of your possessions. That's just a tithe you can do.
Mm-hmm.
We
will send you 2 shoots of a fungus-resistant American elm. 2 shoots!
of plump, juicy raisins? You can send those to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Here's something we got in the mail recently, John. When I showed you the box, you admired that it was actually a civil defense, an authentic civil defense box of the...
Of
the Cold War era.
I didn't just admire it. I gasped when I saw it.
I've never seen you so happy.
It's right there.
As when you saw this authentic civil defense
box. Civil defense radiation detection kit box.
And you know what the person sent us in that box?
What?
A civil defense radiation detection kit.
Oh my God! It's a Geiger counter.
I think it's it may be decorative only.
No, that's a real Geiger counter, is it not?
I just don't think it's functioning anymore, according to Jeremy, who thinks we should use this to decorate the bunker. Oh, but look at that. It's got the civil defense logo.
Pass it over. You know, my dad was a civil defense officer in the 50s.
Well, he would have had one of those. Did he scan you every night when you came home?
He didn't. I wasn't alive in the 50s because I'm not a boomer. What do we got in here? Whoa.
You immediately, like, open up to see its guts.
Yeah, well, there's no... I wanted to make sure there's no batteries in it, and there aren't, but... Oh, it smells like the... It smells like an Air Force base in the 1950s inside, which is one of my favorite smells.
It smells like the Quonset hut inside my heart. It
smells like victory.
That's really great. Thank you, Jeremy.
Jeremy, that is one of the greatest. Now, but this is an example of one thing... And you and I are—I guess we have to keep it in the bunker because neither of us would ever agree to let the other one have it, right?
It's true. It's
wow! It's got a little door that shuts over the the detector thing.
Patreon subscribers can see a picture of this beautiful bright yellow artifact on our video feed.
How awesome is this thing?
At patreon.com/omnibusproject.
I feel like this door is in here backwards, though.
We appreciate your donations. You can discuss Dutch Elm disease or pretty much anything else you want with your fellow futurelings. If Facebook, Reddit, or Discord still exist in your era, first of all, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But second of all, please use it to find other omnibusianados, as we refer to our fans.
I feel like somebody might have hit this with a paint gun that shouldn't have been painted here, but maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, the paint is in really good shape. Do you think it got spruced up at some point?
I feel like maybe somebody spray painted parts of it with the spray paint and they didn't close the door on the detector. This part
shouldn't be yellow?
Maybe that should. I don't know. I've been a long time since I built my own Geiger counter.
But as somebody who only wants original Led Zeppelin concert tees, you're wary of somebody doing restoration work on your new.
This is the only one of these I've ever held in my hand, so I'm pretty excited about it.
And he also sent us these little laminated Connell Rad in case of attack stickers. Turn your AM radio dial to 640 or 1240, John. That's where you'll hear the latest civil defense updates.
So boss. You know, one of us actually has a bomb shelter. It's me.
So you're saying you should put that in your bomb shelter?
No. He gave it to us for our bunker.
Are you going to turk out your bomb shelter like a bomb shelter?
I'm kind of thinking about it. I mean, I don't want to deck it out as a 50s bomb shelter, although I do, but I also kind of want to make it like a contemporary bomb shelter full of all kinds of weird prepper deer camouflage baseball hats and tubes of chewing tobacco.
I don't know where you're going to keep your assault rifles otherwise, so.
Right. I'll tell you what, when the big one hits and you're knocking on my door, you're going to have to know the passcode.
There is no way I'm walking to Normandy Beach after the bridges collapse to ask for your dried meats.
There's a 30% chance that you'd be at the house anyway.
A 30% chance. Only if the world ends on a Wednesday, I guess.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We may be communicating with you from the very distant past, or from the recently distant past. One of the distant passes. Pasts. Not passes.
Pastuses.
Pastuses. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.